Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Creative Futurism. I'm John Best.
And I'm Kevin J. Anderson.
And I'm Brett King.
Oh, and there's Brett.
Oh, he introduced himself. What a guy. Good. That saves our work.
Well, everyone else was doing it. So.
I love it.
Hey, it's our podcast. Quit hoarding it.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. So we'll get right to it here. So this week we have noted author, best-selling author, New York Times best-selling author, and author of Bank 4-0, author of Augmented, also the CEO of Movin, and a friend of mine, who I'm glad to say. And this week we're going to talk a little bit about sort of the future, his last book, Augmented. We're going to talk a little bit about techno-socialism, and I want to touch on Bank 4-0. So welcome, Brett.
Thanks for having me back, John. It's always good fun.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm excited because we've got the other best-selling author with us, Kevin J. Anderson, who you've read his books, right? So
absolutely.
Very, very cool. I hadn't realized that when I invited you on the show. Yeah, I just finished Clockwork Angels, which was amazing. So now we have you two geniuses on the show here. I just can't wait to lob some things out there. So let's get right to it then. So I'm going to lob out the first thing. So in your book, Augmented, you kind of talk about how the technology cycles are continually getting faster and faster and how that's changing the world around us. And you and I have discussed this on our show many times. But one of the points of this show is that people like Kevin inspire folks like you, Brett, who, you know, kind of make the future, right? So Kevin will, you know, we talk about it, I like to think of it as the Star Trek effect, right? You're watching the old Star Trek movie, you see the communicators, and suddenly we get the cell phone, right? And then we just recently had Doctor, is that how you say it, Kevin? You have to put the two doctors
Dr. in? Dr. Harry Clore, yes, that's how he likes to pronounce it.
Right, because he's the only person ever to get two doctors at the same time, two PhDs at the same time. And one of his X prizes was the tricorder, right? And so, you know, in your book, Augmented, those are the kinds of concepts that you bring together. So why don't you give us just a little background for the audience on Augmented, and then Kevin, I'm sure, has 4 million questions, and we'll just get rolling.
All right.
You know, so I'm a frustrated sci-fi author myself, right? I haven't written it. You know, I wrote a sci-fi novel, never published it. But, you know, Augmented was my, was cathartic in that respect, in that, you know, I read a ton of sci-fi. I think, you know, if I can be so bold, I like, you know, in terms of Kevin's stuff, you know, the Saga of the Seven Suns to me was a great series. The Martian War, you know, I've grown up reading this stuff. Arthur C. Clarke, you know, David Brin, who I mentioned I'm friends with, you know, Greg Bear, you know, I read a lot of this stuff, and it really does fuel the creative juices in respect to what is possible. But the difference, I guess, in you know, the sci-fi stuff, most of the sci-fi stuff is looking a lot further out, whereas you know, you try and take inspiration from that and say, you know, what's possible in the next 10 to 15 years based on the trends that we're seeing right now developing. So, you know, there's a couple of clear trends, obviously, you know, the incorporation of personal assistance, so a voice-based IA, you know, incorporation of mixed reality. These are some trends that we can clearly see people investing a ton of money in, a lot of time in. But where sci-fi helps you round out a picture of where this is going is, you know, the story arcs of a lot of the science fiction stories put these technologies in place as sort of mature technologies. So it really does help you visualize and you know, come up with a way to sort of frame this in terms of its impact to society.
Well, of course, what science fiction always does is that we like the disruption part of the process too, because that's the fun part of the story, because we like our favorite phrase here is, but something went wrong. So you come up with this idea of what if people could telepathically communicate and how great that would be. But of course, what people would really do is they would be sending obscene telepathic text to each other.
And you'd have to have a software filter in your neural interface to block out all that stuff.
I mean, that's all kinds of interesting things. And right now, our technology is so pervasive and it's changing so quickly. I remember the old Arthur C. Clarke thing that any sufficiently advanced technology is usable for magic. And we're getting so that Siri and pervasive AI in our life. It's just we're getting used to having these deities, for lack of a better word, that these all knowledgeable, hey Siri, what's the weather tomorrow in Gunnison, Colorado, and poof, it shows up, or Alexa, and sometimes you have conversations and Alexa just participates without even being invited, which is kind of surprising. I had something that I just, it went past me yesterday, and then I started thinking about it, and I thought, that's really kind of creepy. That I'm doing a convention this weekend in Dallas, yeah. And I sent a Facebook message to a friend of mine and just said, we're going to be there. How about we get together for dinner on Saturday night? And then Facebook Messenger at the bottom of it said, would you like me to set up a meeting? I can send a reminder to you and your friend 1 hour before the dinner.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just went, oh, that's convenient. And then I went, that's creepy. This thing's reading my email and interpreting it and is responding to it. It's like having a voyeur sitting there looking at who I was going to have dinner with. That was kind of strange.
I heard a great one the other day of two people had met on an aircraft. They'd never met before. They had no friends in common. And when they got off the aircraft, Facebook was suggesting to each of them that they friend this person.
No, I mean, as science fiction, what our thing is to figure out how awful this can be and how people's lives will be ruined. But I was at a panel once when we were talking about like augmented humans with cyber chips in them, and you put the jack in the back of your skull, like the neuromancer and other things.
Yep.
And everybody on the panel, I mean, the conceit of the panel was like, this is scary stuff, and computers are going to take over the human body. And I remember this one guy in the audience who was really getting upset, and he finally stood up and he said, but why is that bad? And we kind of stopped and had to think about it, because, I mean, I rely on Siri for almost everything when I just ask for simple information. I mean, remember, we used to have to go to the public library in the reference section to look up utterly trivial data points that we now just get without thinking.
Yep.
That's, I still have an old World Book Encyclopedia on a bookshelf somewhere. So
yeah, my dad keeps telling me he's gonna leave me his Encyclopedia Britannica, you know.
Yeah, as a token of his world.
Yes. Yeah. You know. But you know, my kids have never had that experience of pulling an encyclopedia off the shelf to look at that information. They're just used to going to Google. And now, you know, my younger son who's 8, he now knows how to talk to Alexa to get that information. So, you know, this is part of this inexorable shift that happens where we, as we get immersed in technology, you know, whether you call it in academic terms, technology, adoption, diffusion, or whatever, we actually get, you know, fairly used to these technology changes. So I think by the time that you can augment your brain with a neural interface, for example, to directly connect to the internet, right now we talk about it and it sounds pretty freaky, but you know, by the time that technology comes along, then we will have adapted to that slowly. We'll have things, for example, that we can wear on our head that will enable us to control drones, or, you know, interface with computer games, or if you're someone with a disability, you know, paralyzed, you'll be able to use your exosuit with that sort of neural interface. And then the next step, you know, we've augmented our vision already, and so, you know, when this stuff comes along, it won't seem as dramatic to us as it does today when we talk about that stuff. You know, we as we get more immersed and more technology becomes involved in our life, these things become less threatening and less of an issue.
You know, to make that point, Brett, I was thinking of something the other day. You know, remember when everybody was walking around with the Bluetooth things in their ears? That, you know,
yeah.
And they all look like cyborgs, which I'm sure Kevin really enjoyed. He was like, oh, my dreams are coming true. Everyone's a cyborg. But, you know, that kind of prepared us for, you know, I think to your point, it's sort of this thing. You get desensitized, I think, is what you're saying to these things.
Yeah.
Plus,
yeah.
On top of that, some of the problems are sort of worked out that would be the "and something went wrong" problems in the earlier stages of that. So, for instance, I actually have been experimenting, and I think you and I probably are under the same device here, with a device you put on your head that you can control a block, you could spin it with your mind, you can turn it around. I actually demonstrated some of that at AXFI, and I've gotten it now to where I can think about my balances, and I could get my balances back. But, yeah. You know, I have to wear this goofy thing on my head that if I walked around with it, and plus, I don't know, if, you know, if you've been experimenting with it, you have to take it, soak the whole thing in saline before it'll work because it's an EEG, right? So I don't think anybody's going to be cool with me walking around with saline dripping off my head. But you're saying we'll overcome that because these things will get taken care of over time.
Yeah, it's just a progressive immersion in this tech. So, you know, if you think about the technology we have today, just, you know, in reference to Kevin's earlier quote from Arthur C. Clarke, if you went back to the 1900s and pulled out a smartphone, well, it wouldn't work, but, you know, because there's no cell towers, except that, yeah, you could play some save videos on it and things like that, but people would think it was magic and people would, you know, and if you tried to explain the concept of how people live in society with these devices, they would think of it like science fiction. But today we just think of it as normal. You know, we, you know, if you took this smartphone, like an average iPhone or a Samsung Galaxy, you know, back to 1990, we're talking about, in supercomputer terms, a computer that's worth $30 or $40 million in processing power, you know, of that time. And yet we carry these things around in our pocket, and instead of being blown away by the fact that we've got a supercomputer in our pocket, we're taking selfies and updating a Facebook status,
you know? Oh, and complaining about it, this darn thing. But so are you saying that if I took my iPhone back to like the 1800s, they'd make me their king?
Undoubtedly.
That's a book, Kevin. That's a book, Kevin. You should write a book. This guy goes back in time with his smartphone. It's Brett King, and they make him king because he has a cool British voice. He'll do better as king. But,
well, you know, that was basically called A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. It was written quite a while ago. So,
oh, darn it. All my ideas are always taken.
That's the sort of thing there is. But there's, I mean, we should be thinking about this because in our own lives, things have changed so much. It's accelerating, but even back 20 years ago or when we were in high school, I remember the big debate of whether you could use calculators or not.
Right.
And do either of you remember how to sit down with a piece of paper and do a long, complicated, long division problem? I don't know how to do long division anymore. I did in fourth grade, but why would I have to do that any more than I need to know how to make soap from scratch? But but one of the things I'll put on my Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, the technophilic science fiction writer, instead of the Michael Crichtons that no matter what you invent, something terrible is going to happen. All of this stuff frees the human being and the human mind from wasting time on piddly crap. Right. I mean, I don't have to spend an hour doing long division. I can get the answer in a second. And I could spend the rest of that hour doing something that only I as a human being can do rather than a machine. And I don't have to spend hours in the reference section in the library to look up chemical names of nylon fibers or something like that. I can get that information instantly. And then as a scientist or as a futurist or something, I can spend all my time doing the cool imaginative stuff rather than the grunt work stuff. So that's great, but it also goes back to the let's get robots to do all the work, and then oh horrors, robots will take away all of our jobs. And you know, that seemed 10, 15 years ago when I was starting to reread Dune over and over again, where a lot of the terrible thing is the machines taking over, and they've overthrown them so that you don't have to worry about machines disrupting people anymore. And that all seemed a sort of a quaint 1960s paranoia when robots were taking over assembly lines. And we forgot about it for a while, but now it seems to be coming around where, oh, wow, there's AI and artificial manufacturing, and there's even fast food jobs where there's no people there. You walk up and you touch a touchscreen and your order appears. Yeah. So it's almost come full circle where science fiction has predicted technology to do all of the busy work, the grunt work. But the problem is we have a lot of people that need to have jobs doing the busy work and the grunt work. So
this is the yin and yang of technology, isn't it? You know, we love to adopt technology. We absorb it as fast as Apple and these other guys can produce it. But, you know, there is that yang of it. And, you know, this is how I started off the book Augmented, where I started talking about the Luddites in England, you know. And, you go back to 1812 and you see this massive disruption because of the steam machine. And, you know, these militias formed of these displaced workers from textile factories going in and smashing up steam engines and killing factory owners. And I mean, this was, there were more troops deployed in 1812 in Britain, stopping the Luddites from destroying factories with steam engines, than there were deployed a few years later protecting Britain from France, you know? Wow. So, you know, I mean, so you look at that and you say that was really disruptive technology. And then, you know, you come back and just a few years ago when Uber was at its height of disruption, you have taxi drivers in Paris and France, you know, pulling Uber drivers out of their car and setting the cars on fire. And you say, in 200 years, we haven't learned any better to deal with that level of technology disruption that happens in terms of the workforce. So, you know, when artificial intelligence starts to impact and automation impacts employment, you know, we're not ready for it. Even though we know it's inevitable based on those technology trends we've seen over the last 250 years. Because when you examine it, and you examine all of those businesses that were affected by technology, whether it was the internet, the telegraph disrupting the Pony Express, whatever the technology was, and you know, you've got some guy sitting in an office going, "It's not going to change our business," you know.
Mm-hmm. So
and yet inevitably it does.
Yeah. So Kevin, your thoughts on how does society start keep from, you know, doing the same thing over and over again where we don't anticipate this? You know, you hear this about the coal miners too, right? You know, the idea that, hey, we're moving to clean energy, but yet we somehow miss the point that there's that human element that they need to, you know, these people can't be displaced. How do we avoid that?
I think the problem is we think of how efficient it'll be when we have technology to do something, and that's absolutely correct. But we don't think about, but what do you do with the people who really aren't skilled or qualified to do anything other than the manual labor? And what do you do with them? And my very first novel, Resurrection Inc., was a future where they basically figure out a way to jumpstart human dead bodies to be like bargain basement androids. You don't have to build androids, they're just bodies. And they do all the ditch digging and handle toxic waste and all this stuff. And the guy who invents this is this idealistic person thinking, I'm going to free the human race so that they don't have to do this hard grunt work anymore. And they'll have all of this time to create art and music and literature and poetry. And they'll reach their human potential. And then he gets really jaded and pissed off when people don't actually do that. They just sit around and complain. And I actually think that's part of our human race, that there are going to be some that if you free them to reach their potential, that they will devote their energies to other things. But a lot of people will just grumble that they've got too much time on their hands and they got nothing to do. And that's a human nature thing. And I don't know how you solve that, because the coal miners, what do you do if the coal miners don't have a job and you just pay all their bills? Well, are they going to go out and become painters? And I don't know, some of them might, but what are they going to do?
Yeah. This is where I find it really interesting, Kevin, about the fact that in parallel to the whole automation thing in AI that's going to disrupt a large portion of the workforce in developed economies, you know, particularly, even more so maybe in developing economies like China. But when you look at that in parallel, we see this interesting technology of VR. So people are going to be able to immerse themselves in virtual worlds, you know, in a couple of decades as robots are taking our jobs, you know. So the ability for you to absorb yourself in this, particularly if you've got something like universal basic income that may emerge as a construct to prevent social unrest when there's higher unemployment, then you could very well just sit in a VR induced coma, right?
Yeah. So back up to the income there. I want to get Kevin's thoughts. I also want to explain it just real fast, because I'm not sure all our listeners would know what you were talking about there. So give us, you called it universal basic income, I believe, right?
Okay. So one of the, and this comes back to what I'm writing about in techno-socialism. If you look at the changes that are wrought by high levels of automation. So in the United States, you know, various studies like the Oxford study have predicted that about 45% of US jobs could be impacted by automation, right? So, you know, if you think about 45% unemployment, and that's assuming we don't create new jobs with artificial intelligence that could replace all of those. But let's say 25% unemployment. That's still, you know, unsustainably high levels of unemployment. So what do you do with those people? Well, if you say, well, we, you know, that's their responsibility. ability to get a job, then you risk having a whole lot of Arab Spring type events with social unrest, because, you know, it's probably the kids coming out of university with massive student loans that can't get a job that are going to be affected by this. So one way to combat that risk is to provide a universal basic income structure or a universal basic asset structure, which basically provides them with, you know, a house, you know, ongoing education, enough cash to get food to eat and basic healthcare covered, right? And then on top of that, if they want the new iPhone, they're going to have to go out and get a part-time job, you know, repairing robot pizza delivery drones or something, right?
So
where does the money come from for the universal basic income? Because the automation has made it so much more profitable that the industries are then taxed and that money goes to providing.
This is the basic concept. And you know, the big supporters of this actually tend to be guys in the technology field who are saying that, you know, like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg's a big proponent of this, as is Elon Musk. And they're saying, we recognize that these technology companies are going to have to bear that. So that's either going to be, you know, provided as a social program provided by these technology leaders that have hundreds of billions of dollars of cash sitting in the bank, or trillions potentially, or you know, will be some sort of taxation built into the robot infrastructure, robot tax, and so forth. But you know, again, there are questions politically. It would be untenable right now in a country like the US, or you know, in Australia or the UK. But ultimately, you know, governments are going to have to make that decision. Do they provide, you know, some sort of infrastructure or a social net for those people affected by automation, or do they try and combat the social unrest that comes with that? And I think the social cost of automation could be extremely high if we don't have something like a universal basic income, which is why I think it, you know, inevitably we'll get there.
Well, I think even once you have automation in industries and it takes care of a lot of the basic work, anybody who works in like volunteerism or community service stuff knows that every city has an office with shelves and shelves full of like binders with community projects that need to be done, whether it's being a docent at the library, whether it's maintaining trails in the parks and all kinds of stuff. So there's a lot of work that would still need to be done, even if you have robots running the factories and the McDonald's cashier counters. So if we are willing to say everybody gets their universal basic income, but they are required to do one day a week right, community service, that does not seem too high a cost for me. As I told you before we started recording, I just did I did two mountain climbs here in Colorado yesterday, and I'm very attuned to a lot of our trails that have not been maintained for decades because there's no funding in the forestry department. So I would love to. And in fact, if I were on the other side of it and I had to do one day a week community service, hey man, put me out on the trail. I'd be happy with something like that.
You know, and this is where I think is a really interesting opportunity, Kevin, because I think if you think about the biggest challenges facing us over the next, 50 years, particularly around climate shift, and climate change, you know, imagine tying geoengineering to a universal basic income. And that's something that I think our kids could get passionate about. And I think that, you know, if you were able to say to them, go out and do this geoengineering project, and we will give you a basic a salary for that, then that's a way to really change that infrastructure around adapting to climate shift.
Wow. So I was just, while you were talking about that, Brett, my brain was just sort of out in the future. And I was thinking about our kids, and I was thinking that you're right, they would do something like that. If there was some website, like this one big website, like the Facebook of universal basic income, and there were these jobs you could sort of pick off that site, and, you know, using identity or using some of the technology we have to validate that they actually did this, because that would be the other thing, is to confirm the service work. You're right. I think they would do it. I absolutely think they would do it. Wow.
There's your next startup, dude.
What's that?
There's your next startup.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hey, I'm in if you're in. So real quick, excuse me for a second. Let's talk about We'll start over there. Sure, I'll cut this out. But let's talk about your new book that's coming out. You mentioned it just a minute ago, but it was only fleetingly, Techno-Socialism. I really wanted Kevin to hear kind of the thought process behind this and to get his comments on it, because I really think this would be an interesting conversation, if you're okay, kind of. And you already sort of segued into it. So give us a little background on After Bank 4.0, which is going to come out soon, which is I've already got in my list. But then you've got another one next year that's Techno-Socialism.
So, you know, this actually is sort of a sequel to Augmented. So in Augmented, you know, I started getting into the challenges society would face by these high levels of automation. And then you start thinking about what is the emergent, system of government that comes as a result of this high level of automation. Well, the first thing you get is that government will tend towards high levels of automation and resource allocation and so forth based on technology. So you won't run a city with a whole lot of civil engineers doing this, working out, water flows and things like that. It'll be AI based. Transportation systems will be heavily automated. Taxation, most likely in the medium term, will move to some sort of real time element embedded in the transactional activity we do, especially when people can get paid in altcoins and things like that for the work they do. So, what you end up having is a situation where government sort of shrinks, but then you say, what is the government model? What is the type of government that will emerge in this marketplace where we're saturated in technology with heavy automation? And how do you manage a constituency that has this problem of, time on their hands and, lack of employment? So this does tend towards the fact that economies will have to become more socialist in nature, but there's elements of this where when we think about socialism today, particularly in the US, it's almost spoken of like communism was in the 70s and 80s, right? It's this evil word, but there's an element of this where you say, well, let's think about something like universal healthcare. So right now, the cost of universal healthcare could be massive to an economy like the United States. But when you throw in, 20 years down the line, gene therapy, gene editing, personalized medicine, sensors that we wear on our body or ingest to give us feedback, apply that data to artificial intelligence so we can predict when we're going to be sick, And so we really have this situation where we're able to monitor our health in such effective ways that we're not getting as sick often, and we're starting to anticipate problems. For example, now, if we can predict you're going to have a heart attack because you're wearing a smartwatch that links to AI, and we can stop you from having a heart attack, in California, that's a $90,000 event, right? So we can use a $50 sensor on your wristwatch, and now we can prevent a $90,000 cardiac event from occurring. So the cost of providing universal health care in this techno-rich world could be dramatically reduced. Same for education with universal internet access with virtual reality, where you could sit inside a classroom and receive, a Harvard education at home. So there's many elements to this where the technology leads us towards a socialist type platform, but at a very, very low cost. So you get, the conservatives today talk about, reducing the size of government. But what if technology was the way to do that? What if technology was the way to reduce the cost of delivery of all of these governmental services and universal education and universal healthcare to your constituents? At that point, why wouldn't you deploy that technology to do that? So ultimately, you come up with a society that, because of technology embedded in these core services you need to provide your citizens, you end up looking very socialist in nature.
Hmm. Well, the technology you need to develop, though, would be a bureaucracy dissolving device. I'm listening to all the things you're saying, and I'm going, that's great, but I've worked for off and on for the military, for the Air Force. I'm now in the midst of wrestling with academia to get a degree so that I can teach and stuff like that. Just dealing with people that are so entrenched with certain ways of doing things, it would seem to me an insurmountable problem to have the idealistic way of course this would be more efficient. Everybody can see that, but getting through the bureaucracy is going to be a difficult problem. So one of the other things I wanted to bring up is it goes back to the socialism thing. So when you have a bunch of people sitting around, the previous communist and socialist idea was if you have 10 people, they're all going to work together for the common good and they're all going to work just as hard as everybody else. And that, of course, didn't work because you have 10 people putting together. You have one or two hard workers and a bunch of other people that like to watch. And if you have so many people who are displaced from their jobs, even if they're given a universal basic income so that they've got food, shelter, heating, internet, whatever that the basic essentials are, you're going to get some people that will actually take the reins and decide to do something productive with it, and other people will sit around and play Candy Crush all day long.
Exactly. And that's, you know, as we go through this adjustment in society, you know, the best thing we could do is start to educate our children on the fact that, A, they need to be extremely adaptable to survive in this future, you know, that they're not going to have a career for life and things like that. But we really need to start preparing society for these inevitable shifts. Now, we talk a lot about AI. And we talk a lot about the threat of AI, for example, right? You know, robots are going to take over the world and those sort of things. But we don't actually talk about, in realistic terms, the impact these things are going to have on industries and so forth, even though based on trends, you know, we've got a fair idea of what's going to happen. Because, you know, if you look, just look at the last election cycle in the United States, Donald Trump coming out and talking about we're going to bring back big oil jobs and coal jobs. You know, if he was realistically talking to constituents, he'd be saying, well, we're going to create 30 or 40 million jobs in solar, but that means inevitably that the jobs in big oil and coal are going to be displaced. And that's a sort of a grown-up discussion that we need to have, but there's a lot of other things that come into play there that prevent those sort of grown-up discussions from happening.
Well, and that actually raises the question that I don't know the answer to. With we keep hearing the yes, the coal jobs will go away, but then you're going to get a bunch more solar jobs. Yes, the robots are going to take over the assembly lines in the factories, but you're going to need to hire people to fix the robots when they break down, or to design the robots, or to program the robots. Do you have any sort of general knowledge about, is that a one-to-one thing for every factory job that a robot displaces workers, that there's another job created to fix the robot? Or is it they displace 50 jobs and there are 10 new jobs created?
So I did a lot of research on this in Augmented, Kevin, and what you saw is that when you see these major step changes in technologies like the steam engine and so forth, you have jobs move out of one industry into another industry. So when you look at farming, for example, agriculture in the United States, in 1850, 73% of the U.S. labor force was employed working on farms. Today, it's 1.6% of the labor force. So when you look at that, when you look at sort of in the early 1900s, as tractors started to be used on farms, you can see the line of you know, people working on farms decline at the same rate number of tractors go up. You know, so there's a direct correlation. So you look at that and you say, that's really bad. These tractors took all these jobs. But what was happening at the same time was the creation of the Model T Ford production line and you know, the manufacturing industry, which many economists in the United States say, you know, was responsible for the creation of the U.S. middle class. So you have all of these jobs created in factories. So people move out of agriculture into factories. And then, you know, when the IT era computers came along in the 60s and 70s, we have people moving out of manufacturing into service industries. So the real question is, you know, is there a one-to-one correlation? Well, if you look at the internet, for every job the internet displaced, about 2.6 new jobs were created created. So this is pretty positive. A lot of that comes from the wealth that the internet boom created. And undoubtedly, there's going to be some of that from artificial intelligence. The problem is that we're attacking service sector. We're attacking, restaurant workers, janitors with robotic cleaners. We're attacking accountants, lawyers, and bankers who are doing heavily processed stuff that we can teach machines with machine learning to do now. So we're going to see for the first time these sort of white-collar jobs and the service industry jobs attacked. But then the question is, if they move out of the service sector, what sector do they move into? And that's the question we have.
So I had a weird idea while you were talking. I'm going to throw at both of you. So I love this point that you're making is that, it's for the first time ever, we're going to see these white collar jobs. So what if the problem is actually working? What if the answer in the future is some sort of like, think of it like mining in the cryptocurrency, like, something that you do, like, do you, either of you guys remember the old SETI project? Did you ever run SETI on your computer?
Of course.
Sure.
Of course you both did. Yes, and I did too, because I was sure.
In the screensaver, right?
Yeah, I was sure that my computer was the one that was going to find the alien communications, right?
Well, explain it, John, because a lot of the listeners might
sure.
Know
so what. SETI stands for the search for extraterrestrial, the last line was what? Life.
Intelligence,
that's it. And so there's a huge giant dish. I don't even know where it is. You probably do, Kevin. But it's pointed at the sky and it's collecting all this information, radio waves that come from outer space. And then what ends up happening is that data was so, there was so much of that data out there that they couldn't possibly process it. And this was way back then. It's one of the first examples of distributed processing, just absolute genius, that all these computers were sitting around at home at the time. So people didn't have laptops that they sort of shut down and set aside. They had a place in their house that had a desk and a computer sitting there that was pretty much running all the time. And it would turn to a screensaver so that these old cathode ray tubes wouldn't burn in the image that was there. And so what they would do is SETI got smart and said, we built a screensaver so that when you're not using your computer, we can send you information that we've collected from outer space and your computer's processing power can be used to look for anomalies or look for the presence of intelligent life or intelligence in these signals. And what I'm thinking is, would something similar be happening as you were talking about, and I'm getting out there, so go with me, guys, because it's supposed to be a science fiction thing. So you were talking about plugging people's brains in or whatnot. What if you could just sort of plug your brain in, because we're going to need this brain power. I predict that there's something to go there where you go, okay.
So you become a Bitcoin mining rig, your brain.
Yeah, like that, because the problem is that people don't want to get up and go do things. Okay, so, all right, well, what if you could just sort of go, I'll get my money, and the way I'll get my money is, while I sleep, I'll plug this thing in my head.
I'll become a distributed processor.
I guess. I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there.
That's called the Matrix. We've all seen it.
Yes, exactly.
What? Hey, I thought that went pretty well. The people, everybody all identifies with the Neo, but I remember the people that were in the other scenes around there, they seemed pretty happy. Yeah. They got steak. Remember that one guy?
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, he wanted to get back in the Matrix. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's my point, is there something like that? And I'm taking this off on a tangent, but that was just fascinating to me, the discussion around, because it seems to me the problem is that the motivation, the will, right? The will of people, it comes back to people. It's always about that. And so some people just don't have the will to go and change. Some people just don't have the will. And you know what? They look at it and go, why should I? And that's a challenge, right? But if you could find something that I think would be better for them, to where they wouldn't feel that way, then maybe they might be interested. So that, I just want to plug Brett King's brain in and see if he can find intelligent life. That's all I'm saying.
Well look, sorry, you go ahead.
Just quickly, there was an episode of Black Mirror. It's an anthology show on Netflix that, in fact, it just won an Emmy last week, I think, where it's in a future where everything's automated and people don't have anything to do. And the way they earn their money is these people are basically plugged in on treadmills, and they're walking on treadmills or exercise bikes, and they're just playing games, and their exercise bikes are generating the energy that runs the whole computer that guides society. And I liked what you suggested, John, about if people don't have to do anything, that they can use the 98% of their brain that they're not using, and it can be used as a distributed processor. I think a lot of people will do it. And again, like I just mentioned, I did a really hard hike and mountain climb yesterday, And I've got a lot of other people that go, well, why would you do that? Why not just sit home and read? And I like to go out and do things, and I like to accomplish things, and I like to be proactive and be that kind of person. But that's not everybody. There are a lot of people who, in fact, my own sister, when we had a day off of school, when we were in high school, we had a day off of school. I just thought of all the things that I could write, and I could read stuff, and I could go places. And for her, it was, oh, great, a day I can sleep until noon. Yeah. And there are people, two different types of people. There are some people that really do just want to sit around and sleep in or play Candy Crush or whatever. And there are other ones that go, oh, look at that mountain, I want to climb that. And it's not something fixable. It's just different types of people.
Yeah, I think as a society, we can start to address this, you know, with education and so forth. It's the same way we deal with other epidemics like drug use and so forth. We'd have to have a systemic approach to this as, you know, sort of find your purpose. I like sort of the Japanese concept of, it's called ikigai, where, you know, you figure out what the world needs, what you're good at, what you love doing, what you can get paid for, and that should become your purpose. And you know, I think we're going to have to start thinking about social constructs or structures that sort of fit more like that. Is if your purpose isn't to work 9 to 5 to pay to eat, you know, then, you know, when you have that freedom to choose something that you really love to do, then, you know, how do you go about doing that? And I as a society, that shift, if you think about it, you know, that shift has sort of started, you know, with the Industrial Revolution. For the last couple hundred years, we've been so focused on the fact that work is so central to our existence, that moving away from that requires a massive shift in psychology and, you know, our approach just generally to life. And you know, it's probably going to take another 100 years for us to get used to the fact that we don't have to work to eat.
It probably will. Yeah.
Isn't the point of working so that you can have money to pay your bills to do the fun stuff that you want to do? And so we're kind of cutting out that middle step, that we don't have to work to get the money. We just, all day long, we can do the fun stuff that we want to do, which I would assume is kind of like the end game of evolution and civilization and technology, yeah, right? We should having a technology where we don't have to work. Everything's taken care of because the society's working.
Yeah, I think we call
Star
that
Trek
the
economics.
Yeah, we call that the WALL-E effect, right? The end of WALL-E, right? The Pixar movie, which everybody looked at and went, "Wow, that's horrible." And I looked at and went, "Man, that seems awesome." It's it's like an old cartoon I saw once. It was a text. There was a site called Text with Dog, and the dog is texting the human, and he goes, "Hey, what's fat?" And he goes, "Oh, that's where you eat too much food and lie around all day." And the dog replies, "Fat sounds awesome. Let's be fat."
except that with gene therapy, you probably won't get fat.
Right? Oh, see? Thank you, Brett. Oh, man, that fixes everything. Yeah. Great, Kevin.
Now that's kind of scaring me, because now I'm realizing that is sort of the thing we should be striving for, so that our society is running well enough that everyone has food and shelter and they have everything that they want. And then what would you do? Say you're the crown prince of something or other, and you've got the treasury of the country, and you can do anything you want all day long. What would you do? And some people would do lazy stuff and lie around and entertain themselves. Other people would actually invent things or write things or accomplish things, and it's different types of people, and I can't imagine sitting around doing nothing all day long. In fact, I was at I did some volunteer work for one of our state parks, where you had to you know, clean up the trails and the picnic areas and stuff, because that's what I wanted to do. And it rained one day, just downpour, so we all had to go into the shelter building, and the two guys who were actually on salary, the guys being paid for being there, and I was a volunteer, the guys being paid said, "This is great. We can sit around and do nothing all day and still get paid for it." And those were probably the three most mind-numbingly boring hours of my entire life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the other issue is there are some people who will do nefarious things with that time, unfortunately. And that's the bigger challenge.
Human nature.
Yeah, it really is. So we're getting close to the end here. I wanted to take a minute, and I just wanted to, first, it's been really cool to be a fly on the wall with you two with a conversation. I was anticipating this all week, and it was exactly what I'd hoped for. Neither of you disappointed. So, Brett, you know, I know you're speaking at a lot of events coming up. You have your own podcast, which is wonderful. If our listeners,
I'm doing eight countries in October.
You're doing eight countries in October. Yeah, you are the man,
you know,
Brett.
As we were talking before the cast, you know, even being a best-selling author, you know, the easiest way to monetize your books is actually, for me at least, is getting out on the speaking circuit. I make more, you know, out of a couple of speaking gigs that I do out of royalties, frankly. So,
yeah. So tell us a little bit about where you're going to be, which eight countries. Also, there's BrettKing.com. I know we can find all of that there. But just if folks, you know, there's a lot of folks who are going to be listening to this podcast who listen to or who read Kevin's stuff. And one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show is I think they would truly love Augmented. So talk a little bit about what's coming up for you. And where we can find you.
I'm in Chicago next week, and then I fly to Hong Kong. I finish out the week in Hong Kong. Then I'm back to Quebec, where I've got an event for the Insurance Bank of Canada, or Insurance Association of Canada. And then I fly to the to Sochi, do an event in Sochi. Then to Barcelona. Then I'm back to the US to Boston and Richmond. Boston is an event for a group of neurosurgeons. That's going to be interesting, talking about some of the stuff we talked about today. And after Boston, I go back to Russia. And that takes me to about the 18th of October. And then I'm in Vegas for Money 2020. Do the closing keynote on Monday afternoon. Well, it's actually not a keynote. It's a debate with Steve Ellis from Wells Fargo on whether we need banks in the future. So that's sort of...
He's going to have a tough road given the CFPB's position on them.
Absolutely. So that's...
If anybody thinks that sounds like a glamorous life, you're crazy. I think Brett would much rather be doing it as a VR conference or something and saying, oh.
I'm good mates with Robert Scoble, and he's been working on that technology. He's done a couple of VR conferences already, so we will get there.
Well, I did a book tour once where I did 37 cities in 38 days.
Oh, wow.
And my neighbor, I came back from that and I was just completely wiped out. And my neighbor said, oh, that sounds so exciting. You must have been felt so glamorous. I went, are you kidding me?
Yeah. Taxi. Hotel, you know, check in, check out, airport, yep. You know, that's it.
Yeah. And I mean, I've just crossed my million mile frequent flyer thing. And I thought that was quite an accomplishment. And then I realized I spent way too much time with my butt in an uncomfortable airplane chair. But anyway, traveling lets you see things like the inside of your hotel room and the check-in desk. And that's about all that you get. But,
well, go ahead, Kevin.
I was just going to say it's been wonderful and imaginative. We could have sat here for hours just bouncing ideas around, because that's what science fiction does. It's not a warning, or it's not a glorious celebration. It's we discuss the ideas, because if nobody thinks of these things ahead of time, then it comes up and it's like walking across a field and you step on a rake and it smacks you in the face. It's good to be thinking about stuff like this, although one of our main points here in this podcast is about the unintended consequences, that this is great, but whoever thought that would happen, because it's so far out of left field. One of the examples we use is who ever thought that everybody having a smartphone would impact the wristwatch industry, yeah. Stuff like that. So I love all these changes. I love your ideas, Brett, and go ahead, John, any wrap up comments?
No, we're going to post, I'm going to put all the information about Brett and his books and everything on our website, creativefuturism.com. And if you're not listening to Breaking Banks, and you know, that's Brett's podcast, which is fantastic. I'm an avid listener. You know, just as you can see, a lot of people think of him as a financial guy, but he's really a futurist. And that's one of the things I love about him. So, Brett, thank you so much for coming on the show.
I had a blast, dude, and look forward to the next one.
Thanks, Brett.
Thanks again.